Let's turn to Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 6. And we end our second major point here, Daniel and his friends in Gentile domination, and kind of get the first half of our book done, and we will move on into more of the prophetic that Daniel is known for in chapters 7 through 12. And so we will, with this event, with Daniel in the lion's den that marks this chapter, we will leave those interactions that Daniel has given to us of Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, as they have interacted with the pagan powers, the Gentile powers, in this case Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and the like, and here now with Darius that we were introduced to back in chapter 5, verse 31, didn't speak to him at that point last week. We'll touch on him as we begin here in a moment. And so we see another Gentile king, ruler, that is having interaction with these Jewish men now. I mean, Daniel is much older by now, by this time. He's no longer that teenage boy that we find back in chapter 1. He has matured, he's grown up there in Babylon. We noted, as we saw the end of it, that Darius the Median had come in and they had taken over Babylon. And so the Babylonian Empire is no more. We're now moving into the Medo-Persian Empire that is over the realm there in the Middle East, and ultimately over Israel, because Israel is not a nation. After the captivity, sending the southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin into captivity by the Babylonians, Israel ceased to exist as a nation, though there are Israelites there, but they're not governing themselves like they were. They're under Gentile domination. And so we have this last event. Yes, it's a miraculous event, much like the other three in the fiery furnace. We have God's providential workings to bring Daniel through this. Again, this is one of those stories that we tend to all know if we've grew up in any kind of Sunday school along the way. These are one of those events that we drive home because we see God at work. And yes, miraculously. And there's, because we have the God of the miraculous. The liberals like to downplay this and say that, you know, this just can't be. When why not? Why limit God? God is the ruler, the creator of these animals. He can certainly shut their mouths overnight and anything else that we see have happening. But there are those out there that think, you know, that just didn't happen. But if we're going to believe the Bible is so, that it's God's word, it's his revelation to us, that it's true, then we are going to believe it. And I think, you know, Daniel will testify to us one day that, yes, those lions didn't do anything that night when we get to meet him one day. But we see the vacillation of Darius here in chapter 6, kind of our main point for the chapter, the main heading for it. And so we look at who is Darius, because we are introduced to him in verse 31, and then it says, and it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. And so we see some structure, if you will, some governmental structure, as Darius is come in. He's over the Babylonian Empire, part of the Medo-Persian Empire now, noting the Median, and I think it's particular there because we have Darius the Median, but soon we're going to come across Cyrus the Persian, and showing us this alliance between these two smaller empires that developed an alliance, and we call it the Medo-Persian Empire to this day. But we will see one of those is more dominant than the other as we get into the prophecies coming up in the coming chapters. But one of the questions that, again, the liberals like to bring up is, We don't find Darius anywhere. There's nothing in the historical records outside the Bible that speak about this man. And so their typical conclusion is, well, then obviously he doesn't exist. Because, hey, if the world's history out there doesn't have it, then surely, why would we have it in the Bible and be correct? And yet, time and time and time again, when we find people like this, eventually the world finds out that what the Bible has said is true. Until about the 1840s, again, secular history said there's no such thing as the Hittites. They don't exist. They weren't back then. What is all these mentionings about the Hittites in the Bible? We don't find any record of them. And then lo and behold, they find records of them. And records, and more records, and more records. We touched a little bit on Belshazzar and who he was and his position and no, we don't really find Belshazzar, so no, I don't think. Oh, okay. Yeah, you did find stuff. And so we come to now Darius, to which I would say, you know, one, is he in the Bible? Yes. Is he a real character? Yes. The world says, well, we're not so sure. Why not? Because we don't believe the Bible. Plain and simple. We don't find any record out there. Well, how much records do you have? Not really a whole lot when you consider the activities of, you know, these couple millennium back that, you know, we were looking at basically two old historians, Herodotus and Xenophon, as our primary historians, if you will. Josephus, of course, with his records that he has, but he's a contemporary in Christ's day and afterwards. So he's writing from other sources as he writes about the history of the Jews, the antiquity of the Jews, and writes about these things. So he's pulling from these others. But, you know, there's not a lot. And what is out there can be at times hard to try to figure out amongst itself, because Herodotus and Xenophon don't agree with each other as they talk about the same historical events. So it's like, okay, so who's the more accurate one to even look at and say we'll follow him as opposed to him as we see these contradictions? And then we bring in the Bible and, okay, where does... And so we don't know. Those that look at these records to the best of their abilities give us kind of two names here. He could be a Gubaru, a man whom Cyrus had made ruler over Babylonia, the old Babylonian Empire, because the Medo-Persian Empire is now even bigger. Medo-Persian is farther east from Babylon in Iraq. I mean, we think of Persia, we think of Iran today, so that's farther east. So it's expanding. They're heading west because they've also gone into what we know as Asia Minor. They've come down into Israel. They've been playing around with Egypt a little bit as well. So that empire is expanding in size as we get into the Medo-Persian Empire. And so we have him as possibly this person, because again, we don't have the name equivalents as we look at those historical records that we find out there. And then we come to the Bible and we have this name, you know, we're not seeing a match. We do find a match with Cyrus. And so we can figure out, okay, the Cyrus of the Bible is, you know, this Cyrus, because there are a couple Cyruses. There's Cyrus the First, and then Cyrus the Second, who is the grandson of Cyrus the First. So there's that possibility. There's another one. It could be Cyaxares the Second. because there are aspects about his life that we have recorded that, okay, one, he's Median. He's from Media, so is Gabaru. They're not Persians, they're from Media. And so it depends on who the conservative commentator that we look at will say. One will say, well, I believe it's Gabaru. Another one may say it's Syraxes. And they have their reasons for it. But when you look at the other things, it's still kind of up in the air. So in a sense, there is a question mark in that we can't identify him with what limited extra-biblical records that we have available to us to look at. Because they in and of themselves don't agree with each other, which makes them not accurate for us to try to examine properly. Because if they don't agree with each other, how can we get the Bible to agree with them, since they don't agree? So we're left with that wondering. But considering all the archaeological work that's going on around the Middle East, chances are we could have something discovered to help verify this Darius and who he is. We don't know. Time will tell. But in the meantime, it doesn't lessen the validity of the Scriptures, because it's God's Word. And God has put that there. He's given us this name. It's a real name. It's a true person. And how that works out in the extra-biblical stuff, we'll just wait to be seen. But we have him, we note him, and so we bring this up. And so I bring that up because there are people that will say, well, you know, you believe that Bible, but, you know, that Darius dude, we're not so sure about him. You know, there's a big question mark who he really is, and he may not even be real. And just let them stew in their juices and to realize that it's God's Word. He's put it there. There's a Darius. And we'll know about him more later. He pops up in chapter 9 as well. But as we move on, verses 1 through 3 show the prominence of Daniel as he writes here. He's one of the three presidents. And so there is seemingly speculation, since there are 120 princes, there's speculation that they divided those 120 into thirds and made one of the presidents kind of overseer of those groups. Each had 40 under them to run the business of the government, and each answerable to one of these presidents, who the three presidents were then responsible and answerable to Darius. So we see some administrative, governmental administration structure being put here. And again, we note Daniel, he's an outsider. He's not Persian, he's not from Media, he's not from Babylon, he's a captive Jew. And yet God has put him there. And much like Esther, I think that phrase that we see in Esther, you know, for such a time as this, God has him there. And we've seen that with these, again, these four men, as they have interacted with Nebuchadnezzar, as they've interacted with Belshazzar. They've had a testimony of the one true God in truly an unlikely place. The very seat of power to this pagan empire. And here are these four men testifying to the one true God. And we've seen the impact that it has had within those nations. And so I trust it will encourage us. We may not be that person, but we may find and know about people who are in places of influence that are believers. We should definitely be upholding them in prayer. And God can use them in those places that they have been placed, and God will use them to be an influence for godliness and righteousness. But we see this prominence, and as we go forward with this, verse 3, then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. In other words, his character, his integrity, the powers that be liked. Which, you know, for the most part, do people like men of honesty, integrity, truthfulness? Yes, we do. Do those cause problems for others? Yes, they do. Because is everybody a person of truthfulness and integrity and honesty? No. And those that aren't, that try other means of advancement, tend to not like somebody that has integrity, that is truthful, that is honest. And we see that happening here as we see the plot, verses 4 through 9, against Daniel. These others, again, he's got kind of two marks against him. One, he's a man of integrity, truthfulness, honesty. Two, he's a Jew. So he's an outsider. But the men that have come up through the ranks by various means, we find them in verse 4. Then the presidents and the princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find none occasion nor fault. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Now it doesn't mean that he was sinless, because Daniel's a sinner just like the rest of us. But as these men look over the governmental records, they don't find that he even jaywalked. He didn't exceed the speed limit in his chariot going through Babylon or wherever else he may have been. You know, there's no traffic infraction on his record. I mean, they're looking and they can't find anything to nail his hide to the wall. How can we get rid of this guy? Well, we're not finding anything in these records. And, you know, they have the Babylonian records available. And however much time that he's had since Darius has taken over, and they're not finding anything, but they want him out of the picture. But they're not finding anything. So we come to verse 5. Then said these men, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." They knew Daniel's testimony. He didn't keep it quiet. I mean, yes, they would have known he was a Jew by many aspects, but they knew that he worshipped his God to the best of his abilities away from home. Verse 6, then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. Again, we note back in verse 31, he's 62 years old. He's 62 years old when he comes in to take over Babylon itself. We don't know how much time has transgressed. So he is an older man at a time when, you know, these ages are older. So we need to bear that in mind as we continue with this. But these men come in and we see the buttering up. King Darius, live forever. Wink, wink, nod, nod. We like you, guy. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save or except of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, are they telling the truth? Notice the first word of verse 7. All the presidents. Now, Daniel's not present with them. So there's only two presidents along with these princes and all these other government officials. So there's one missing in this group that's not there. Yet they have said, all the presidents of the kingdom, all we've come together, we've consulted, and we have agreed that we need to have this statute for 30 days that nobody can talk to their gods or talk to another person to request anything of them except you, because you're the king. Doesn't that sound real good, King Darius? Nobody can ask anything of anybody or any god. They've got to come to you. You are the number one man. Talk about puffing people up, buttering them up. And so we come to verse 8. It says, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. The laws of the Medes and the Persians, once the law was made, the law was made. They couldn't amend it. They couldn't change it. Once it was signed and put into law, that's law. And they know that they've got Daniel. Because they know he's a man of character. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing, verse 9, and the decree. Sure, that sounds good. Nobody can talk to any, you know, nobody can request anything except they come to me. Okay, yes, I'm going to be popular for the next month. Sure thing, you betcha. Let's sign this. Not thinking. I mean, did he see Daniel? No, he wasn't there. So we come to verse 10, we see these men doing this flattery, this deception, if you will, and really the vanity of the king, because it's like, well, sure, why wouldn't I want people to come talk to me about things and request things? Sure, you can come to me. But then we find the prayer of Daniel in verses 10 and 11. It says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled down, he kneeled upon his knees three... Let me slow down, my mind is way ahead of me in the verse. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his window being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found David praying and making supplication before his God. David, Daniel. They're outside his window waiting. Why? Because they know him. Daniel's going to do what Daniel does. He kneels down three times a day with his windows open towards Jerusalem to the west, and he prays to his God. This is how we can get him. We'll have the king sign this decree, and then we'll wait and watch. Sure enough, Daniel does what he's always done. Now again, could we rationalize something like this away, like we could with the Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael with the burning fiery furnace? Bow or burn? Okay, I'll bow, but I'm not bowing to that image. I'm praying to my God while I'm bowing. Could we rationalize something here? Just close the window? Instead of speaking out loud, because obviously he's speaking out loud praying to his God, otherwise they wouldn't know that he was praying to his God. So let's close the window and let's silently pray. I can see people doing that. I don't care to be in a den of lions. So I just won't open my windows for the next 30 days. And I will pray silently. Compromising our own standards, our own beliefs, to accommodate something that God can take care of. But Daniel doesn't do that. He doesn't rationalize, how can I survive this? No, he goes and does what he's always done. God, I'm yours. I've been praying to you for three times a day with my window open to Jerusalem, facing the west, and I have been verbally speaking out, praying to you. I'm going to keep doing that. Regardless of what this decree says, God, I'm going to live for you. I'm going to worship you. And we see scriptures, you know, replete with reminding us of that. Daniel's relationship is unchanged. He's steadfast in his prayers, as we note. And much like the early apostles, the early Christians, as Peter and John are brought in because they healed a lame man, and the religious leaders don't like it. Stop preaching in this name. Verse 14 of chapter 9. But Peter and John answered and said unto them, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you, or more hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye. Who should we obey, you or God? God. God told us to go out and preach the gospel. God told us to go out and proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ and the salvation that's found in him. You're telling us not to, but God's told us to. Who's the higher? These religious officials would acknowledge, well, God is higher. But they're the ones that are telling him to be quiet. And then chapter 5 as well, verse 29, then Peter and the other apostles who had been gathered answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. And when those two enter clash with each other, who do we obey? We obey God. Yes, they have this edict from the government that says, nope, you can only ask of the king. No, I have my God to answer to. I have my God to obey, to call out to, because he's greater than Darius. And so he does. And we see the results of that, verses 12 through 17, the prosecution of Daniel, because they're out there waiting for him to do that. They know he's going to do it because he's a man of character. And so they have the evidence. And so we find in verse 12, then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. I don't think it was too many days after the decree was signed that they come back to the king. You know, kind of like Satan with Job. You have the green light, Job, or you have the green light, Satan, and off he goes to wipe out Job so that he can curse God. Only to find out that he doesn't curse God. I don't think these men waited too long. So they come back to the king. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? Didn't you write this? Didn't you sign this decree, king? Well, sure I did. The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. Then answered they and said before the king that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah. Notice they bring up his Judaism. He's an outsider. We don't like him. Regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. I don't know that the king smacked his head, but I kind of visioned that, realizing he did a dummy. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Pulling out, I'm sure, all the legal manuals, everything about the Medo-Persian Empire's legal system, their decrees and everything else. How can I find the loophole to get Daniel out of this? Because again, remember, we find back in verse 3 that Daniel was preferred above the presidents. Darius liked him. He was promoting him. He wanted him there. And here it is, he fell for this ploy. That's why I say, I whether or not the Persians or Medes smacked their foreheads with their hand, I dare say something along those lines went through him like, I've been had. Been had by these men. They were out to get Daniel. And so he tries to do what he can, you know, within the legal system. How can I get Daniel off the hook? Then these men assembled, verse 15, unto the king, and said unto the king, now, or know, O king, that the law of the Medes and the Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. What a testimony Daniel had before this man. A Gentile pagan king makes that statement. Why would he make such a statement? Because he's obviously had conversations with Daniel about Daniel's God, maybe even about their history of working within the Babylonian Empire. He would have the beautiful story of telling him about Nebuchadnezzar and how he came to know the one true God. Tell the story of his three friends who survived the burning fiery furnace. Our God is able to do that. Our God did that. Daniel, the God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. What a testimony that he has. It says, and a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. They pulled out the wax, got his signet ring, sealed that stone so that nobody would move it. If it moved, the seal was broken, we'd know. And then the king went to the palace in verse 18 and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. He is disturbed. I'm sure on several levels here. I mean, here is a man that he has befriended, that he has brought in, that he is appreciative of, and he's had to put him into a den of lions, possibly killing him because of these other men who did this conniving plot to get rid of Daniel. And he can't sleep. Verse 19, then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, and I'm sure it was, yes, a lamento. O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? I'm sure it was with an expectation. Am I going to hear a voice? Then Daniel said unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. God delivered him. God gave them, as we sometimes will say, you know, rather humorously, they gave them lockjaw. Some have said, yeah, they were nice pillows for Daniel to sleep that night. Well, the king couldn't sleep. Daniel could. God will take care of us. Doesn't mean that he has to do it miraculously. Would Daniel have been upset if the lions had eaten him and he'd gone to heaven? I don't think that would have bothered Daniel any. So again, we need to remind ourselves of that, you know, whether God delivers us miraculously or not, God delivers us. And what a joy that will be. But in this case, he does deliver him miraculously. And there is no hurt. But now the tide has changed as we see the preservation of Daniel. And we see the pronouncement now of Darius. It says, then the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them, and brake all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. And his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth. Who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions? So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. God prospers Daniel. And again, we see Daniel's testimony greatly affecting a Gentile ruler to the point that he would make such a decree. Daniel's God is a God to be reckoned with, and my kingdom will acknowledge it. What an impact. Because these men were willing to stand on their principles, on the truths of God's word, and not compromise them. Not try to rationalize their life away, but realize that their lives are in God's hands. And God will do with us what he pleases so that he can be glorified. And we see that once again in the life of Daniel. As we get into chapter 7, we're going to see the first vision of Daniel. And so we go back in time. As we see, it's noted in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. So we've progressed, but now we go back in time. And I think we noted that. Our chronology is not beginning to end in Daniel. We go forward, then we come back, and then we'll go forward again. So there are some, you know, moving around of these things, and that's why these are noted, so we can see. Okay, we go back in time now. We've moved up into Darius, but now we're going to go back under the reign of Belshazzar and king of Babylon. Daniel has a vision, and we'll look at that next week.